everyone, welcome to Critical Hit, a Major Spoilers Dungeons & Dragons podcast, where we play a game and introduce you to characters and introduce you to gameplay and explain things so that Dungeons & Dragons is more accessible to you at home.
We play a game so you don't have to.
Exactly. All right, before we get into this episode, I know it's been a while. We have just passed a big milestone in the show, and we thought we'd take a moment and go back and reintroduce you to our characters who we're currently playing, some of their stats, and then answer some questions before we get back into gameplay. So my name is Steven, and I play a Eladrin wizard named Orin Rivendorn. He is a tall fellow of 5'10", very thin. And he's got some powers and abilities far beyond those of the mortals and the elves around him. And we'll go into some new powers here coming up, but I thought I'd just let you know a little bit about Orim.
I'm Rob. I play Ket, a Vestige Pact warlock. slightly taller than the apparently tall Rivendorn at 6'1".
What? No, there's no such thing as a 6'1" character in the medieval days.
But you already described your character.
But I'm a half elf with a book imp and some fun personality traits.
Not to be confused with a book elf with a half imp.
Right.
Yep. And I'm Brian, and I play Randus Duthane. He's an artificer, a human. He's slightly shorter than average and doesn't have all sort manner of gadgets and devices within his armor and traveling artificer. And he's been on this adventure for quite some time now.
Okay, and Matthew?
My name is Matthew. I played my first game of Dungeons & Dragons before the Dungeon Master was born. This makes me old and also vaguely awesome. I'm currently playing Halston Thorkelson. Now, Halston is a young man, or rather a young three-quarter orc, who grew up in the city of Moonhold, and he learned two things. And God help him, these may be the only two things he ever remembers. But those two things are, sometimes there are bigger people, but usually there aren't bigger people than him. Torque is essentially a half-orc. I say three-quarter just to annoy Rodrigo. Hi, Rodrigo!
What's up?
Hey. Torque is rather large, not unattractive, actually, for the orc types. Has a pretty serious underbite, grayish skin. Has kind of curled ram horns. If you want to know what Torque's horns look like, really, they kind of look like the rear taillights of the 1990s era Dodge pickup trucks. I realized this sitting in traffic the other day. I'm like, that pickup looks like Ford. Nice. And it has testicles. I'm from Kansas.
I hate those truck nuts.
Torque is basically our meat shield and or brick, depending on how old you are and how long you've been playing the game. Mm-hmm. And I apologize right now for those of you who are new to the show. I want to let you know up front, I'm the attention whore, and I talk a lot. So if that's a problem for you, well, you can fast forward, I guess. I don't know. but, hey, how about them Huskers, huh?
All right. Thank you, Matthew. You're welcome. Also, before we get in, now this campaign is taking place, the Celestial Crusade takes place in an area that's not on the Earth plane, right?
Right. It's not in the natural world.
But it takes place in the Astral Sea, correct?
Correct.
Now, there was one comment that someone made a while ago that said, Rodrigo is not following the rules of the Astral Sea.
Right.
Explain, please, Rodrigo.
Okay.
There's actually a book called The Astral Sea.
The Plane Above.
The Plane Above, yes.
Yep. The setting of Critical Hit is a setting that I came up with. It borrows heavily from a lot of other settings and a lot of other random things that aren't even game-related. But all of the places and all of the people and all of the power players are usually things I made up or different takes on things that were already around. So, for example, the five gods that are the main gods that most, you know, neutral and or good people worship are actually gods from the D&D, from the PHB.
Right.
But I'm probably not going to play them exactly as they are, quote-unquote, supposed to be played. Partially because I don't like the way that they're written, or I don't... I can't be bothered to really go...
I can't be bothered by your rules, Wizards of the Coast.
It's true, and I think... And that's an important thing when you become a game master. You have to decide how much you're going to let the book tell you.
Okay.
Now, there are people who expand this to everything and are basically just free-form running whatever they want and calling it D&D, mm-hmm. which is fine mm-hmm. if your group is okay with it.
Okay.
And there are people who religiously and, you know, just completely... follow everything, including flavor stuff, to mm-hmm. the letter of what the books say.
Well, and that brings up this question from Josh, who says, hey guys, wanted to let you know that I really like the show and that you guys are doing a great job of bringing your own flavor to D&D 4E. I just had a quick comment on something, though. Whenever characters are making an area attack targeting multiple creatures, the attacker only rolls once to determine a hit or miss on all of them. According to the rules, you make separate attacks, but the targets share the damage roll. Each time I hear Orm miss with a power, I wish I could tell him that he could roll again on the next guy. One botched roll doesn't ruin the entire power, unless, of course, you're Randus. Thanks for everything, and here's hoping that all of your rolls are critical hits. That's from Josh.
Right.
And again, some of these questions we've answered before, but people Correct. Keep emailing
this
us.
This one we've addressed several yeah. times.
We have. Probably once about every 20 sessions
episodes,
or so,
yeah.
Somebody sends us an email saying, hey, you guys are doing this wrong.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, you're right. We are doing it wrong. This is... one of my house rules. Right now, I think I'm only using three house rules. One is the area powers. I just have area powers be an all or nothing mm-hmm. proposition.
Mm-hmm.
So just in the same way that you can miss everyone with an area power, you can also crit on everyone in an area power. It, you know, works both ways.
It balances.
This makes things, in my opinion, a little bit faster because you only roll once and you only roll damage once and then you move on.
And especially for a game like this, where you guys don't want to hear us sit and go, oh, there's five. Five against that. No, hit, miss. Five against that.
Right.
Hit, no, miss. 12 against that. Hit, no, miss.
Right.
That could get very boring very quickly.
There are feats out there that specifically reference the fact that you make separate attacks. If you guys ever wanted to think about taking some of those, we could talk about it. Mm-hmm. There are ways that that can fit into my house rule. I have figured it out.
Okay.
And the other two house rules are both relating to skills. One is that I have heavily house ruled skill challenges. They don't work like they're out of the book.
Right.
And then the other one is that I actually do have critical success and critical failure on a 20 and a 1 respectively for skill use in general.
Okay.
which is not something which the book doesn't go into.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, if you roll a 1 on an attack, you fail. If you roll a 20, you crit, mm-hmm. which is an extreme success. And that doesn't apply to skills. But I apply it to skills. So if you roll a nat 20, you succeed wildly. If you roll a nat 1, then you automatically fail.
So everybody here at the table has DM'd games before. What's better? The coming up with your own house rules that work that everybody agrees on, following the rules exactly to the letter, no deviation, or don't even follow the rules at all and just make it up as you go?
The answer is yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Largely.
The only one that I actually have... I have a problem with the two extremes, because doing anything at an extreme is usually problematic.
Right.
Because following the rules to the T, you're going to run into points where the rules don't cover situations that come up.
Precisely. Which
Brian is famously horrible at coming up with situations that happen.
Unintentionally.
Or amazingly good at it, depending on how you look at it.
I hate him so very, very much sometimes. but if you're also running where there's no actual rule structure, it becomes less of a game and more of...
You guys making up a cool story together. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is cool, but which you know what? Fun. There are games that are better yes. at that than Dungeons & Dragons.
As far as everybody just is collaborating.
As far as just like
building.
Freeform.
Yeah.
Well, there's no...
Primetime Adventures.
There should be no hard and fast absolute rules of how to play the game. I've played games where we don't use dice. Mm-hmm. I've played games where the dungeon master insisted on doing all rolls for us to keep everybody honest. And, you know, there are a lot of ways to play the game. This particular game, and I think... understandably so, going into it with a player who's remoting in from hundreds of miles away, and Steven being the brand new player to the game, the nature of this game lends itself well to Rodrigo having the ability to just roll with it. But Rodrigo shares one important rule with me. We usually don't agree wholeheartedly on a lot, except for the premise that Steven is wrong. But the rules are for other people. And, you know, to have the ability for Rodrigo to say, this is the way I want to do this for my purposes, I think that's, I mean, that's the spirit of this game. There are times when I was running particular rounds, especially in college where it was incestuous, where you'd have six players and each of those six players would be running their own round on a different night because we had no lives and most of us were hideous. So we didn't have girlfriends. You know, we'd rotate in and out. We had a town bicycle campaign. But what it really came down to was my friend Ben used to overuse land sharks. Every freaking adventure had a land shark in it. So I made the rule, completely arbitrary, just to be an ass clown, that there were no land sharks in my campaign ever for any reason. Mm-hmm. I just made that, and that was one of my house rules. And the reason for it was I got enough land sharks on Tuesday night. I didn't need them on Saturday. If you don't have, you know, if you don't have the dungeon master of his ability to say, this is how I want this to go, this is where my proclivities lead, this is where my, you know, ridiculous biases lead, then it's not really his campaign to me. It's going by the book.
That and, said, yeah. And I do want to add this. If you are just getting started, try to follow the rules as closely as possible, because the rules that I have picked out and changed are because I am familiar with the rules and because I have sat down and over the course of a lot of games figured out how they change the game.
Right.
If you are not, if you're saying, well, I don't want there to be any grappling because I kind of don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
That's probably not a good reason to outlaw that rule unless that rule is truly actually very complicated.
Right.
And like you don't grappling. Think that it adds anything. Like grappling in a previous edition.
Right.
Nowadays, grappling is not that
it's
complicated.
It's not that bad, no.
Definitely not comparatively. Mm-hmm. So, and that's another thing, is that when you introduce a house rule, you have to be willing to say, oh, you know what, never mind. Because it's entirely possible that your house rule will invalidate things, will make more certain characters more powerful, will tip things in the direction of the players or the NPCs, and you don't particularly want to do either of those.
Mm-hmm. Brian, did you want to add anything?
Largely, I was just going to say that for groups like ours, the house rules are fine because we tend to have a regular pool of people that we game with. Mm-hmm. So we're all pretty much aware of how we play and run things.
Right.
If you're, you know, bit more fluid with the people that you're playing with, it's probably better to follow the rules as written more, because then everybody's coming in with a common footing.
Well, I thought, you know, whenever I ran the game the first time, I found it much better to try to follow the rules, because then I could understand those rules as opposed to making up something arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And I found it was just, to me, it was a little bit smoother game than trying to say, well, here's how this is going to work, guys, or here's how that's going to work.
You have to know the rules before you can break them, but you also have to know the rules before you can change them. And especially in a game where you have either a rules lawyer or the rules lawyer's chaotic evil cousin, the cheating bastard.
Right.
Yes.
Absolutely. You want to make sure that you're hewing as close to, you know, the rules as possible, because there are people who will take a house rule. Specifically, you know, Rodrigo's house rules are, I think, mostly
innocuous.
Enhancing, innocuous. They're not necessarily directly gameplay relating. But if you have somebody in the game who is going to say, you know, Rodrigo doesn't use grappling, I'm going to use that to my advantage.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, you have to have, you know, you have to have something concrete to back him up with. You can't just say, because I said so and it's my world. Right. Even though Rodrigo has said to us, because I said so and it's my world. Because none of us are challenging his ability to say, because I said so. In some games, you'll have that person who wants to challenge or push. And at that point in time, it's good to be able to just lock down and say, page 128 of the PHP, sit down, Woozy.
Sure. I got this email, which I really kind of dug. It's got a classification unclassified, and it's got caveats and everything in there. Nice. And I'm like, what in the heck is this?
For your eyes only, yes. And also everyone else's.
And I was just like, what is this? And I start looking at it, and I see it's from someone stationed in Afghanistan in the military, in the army.
Mm-hmm. He's stationed in an Afghan.
He's stationed in an Afghan. I think it's my grandmother's.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm sending this in reference to the Critical Hit podcast, Stop. I've been listening to it recently, and I've been enjoying it. I quit playing D&D with 2nd Edition and haven't been too keen on picking it up again until recently. I'm currently deployed to Afghanistan with a 15-year-old son at home. He's been talking about playing, and I'm hoping this will be something we can do together when I get back. There are a few enough things that a teenager wants to do with his father, but this may be one. My biggest problem is there are no stores here, and internet access is, well, pathetic. Doing research on what books to get and where to get them from becomes more trouble than it's worth. I'm trying to get your earlier podcast, but 40 to 90 minute downloads when I can connect are not helping the issue. And this person, it's not the first time we've gotten a military email from someone in the military who's been trying to get our shows, and we thank you all for serving our country and everything. And we can understand your problem of downloading something that's 66 megs in size or so. The first question I have is with the PHB 1, 2, and 3, and the Dungeon Master's Guide 1 and 2. Do the later books contain the information in the first books? In other words, do I need to buy one if I just can get two? Can I buy the highest number and then have that information? The answer is, sadly, no.
Correct.
The problem is that each book builds upon information contained in the other book or changes some of the rules that were set up in the previous book.
Your best bet is to get, if you're going to start your own game, basically, which I think is what it sounds like he wants to do, is get the original three books, the first core books, the Player's Handbook, Monster Manual, and Dungeon Master's Guide.
Mm-hmm.
You can usually find all three of them for cheaper than it would cost you to buy each individually.
And they do come bundled in a pack called the Starter's Kit that includes the three books, and I believe it also includes some dice. I can't remember if it's in that one or another grouping, but they do bundle those three books together.
And then after that, since it sounds like, you know, obviously this person doesn't have any trouble getting around on the internet, go to Wizards of the Coast site, which is wizards.com/D&D, like the letter D, the letter N, the letter D, and look up whatever errata is currently available. And then you can just apply that to your PHB and Monster Manual and whatever, and you will have all the rules that you need.
Right.
Yes.
To start. Then after that, if you want to buy more books, go nuts.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you're having trouble finding a place to find the books, GKHobbies.com is the online site of great gatekeeper hobbies, Huntoon and Gage, Topeka, and we do ship around the world, ladies and gentlemen.
And in your neighborhood, I'm sure.
Indeed.
So, Staff Sergeant Gates goes on to say, I'm enjoying Critical Hit, at least I hope it's Staff Sergeant Gates, SSG.
No idea. Okay. I think that stands SSG. For General Halberdier.
SSG, I think, is Staff Sergeant, or maybe Super Cyan Guy.
All right. I'm enjoying Critical Hit, informative as well as entertaining. It has helped rekindle my desire to get back into the world of TSR, I mean Dungeons and Dragons. That's from Staff Sergeant Gates. And thank you so much again for serving our country. Now, this brings up a question that we were kind of touching on a couple of episodes ago when we were bringing up this idea of these essential guides that at the point when we recorded that session had not been released. But now they're out, and you can pick up a few of them. And D&D Brian has picked up a couple already. And some people have asked us, you know, can you spend a little bit more time talking about these essentials books? What are they about? You know, in my mind, they just are essentially a paperback rehash of the things that we find in the hardback player's guides and stuff.
But one of the main things is what they're doing is apparently they're going to kind of phase out the first set of core rule books.
What? Now, Staff Sergeant Gates, we just told him.
Oh, they're still very much available. They're just not going to be reprinting them.
Ah, okay.
They're going to keep the 11 products in the Essentials line as, like, the baseline for newcomers.
So I got to buy all new books or not?
No, you don't need to.
Okay.
You can definitely still use the old ones, and they're still compatible with the new Essentials stuff.
Okay.
The new Essentials stuff, for the most part, either just repackages old information or provides a little bit of new stuff just...
So they can sell it.
Yeah, largely. So they can also get some of the people who are still in the game buying them as well.
Mm-hmm. But so, like, what's some of the new stuff that we have?
What I got the Rules Compendium and the Heroes of the Ninter Vale or whatever.
Forgotten Lands.
Forgotten Lands, that's the one. Yeah, they're basically the rules compendium is just a collection of the rules, all updated and errated and put into a single, relatively cheap $20 book. And that's largely why I got it, just so we have something that's, you know, a little bit more easier, portable, and easier to reference. And the Heroes of the Forgotten Lands does provide some basic versions of basically a fighter, rogue, cleric, and wizard, with new builds of each of them.
No paladin, no acrobat,
no barbarian? On the, they are going to come out with another book, Heroes of the Lost Kingdom or something. Forgotten Kingdom,
I think.
Cavalier?
Yeah. They're going to have the paladin, druid, ranger, and some other class. I can't, a warlock in that one. So
a bigger question then is, and again, when I flip through the rules compendium, sure, there's probably some additions or corrections that are made that were essentially in the errata that Wizards of the Coast have put out.
That's largely it.
So you're talking about these new builds. If I have D&D Insider, right, do I need these, or are those builds already in there?
They're not in there yet. They should be in there come the next update.
Okay.
Which should be hopefully sometime this month, if not next month.
And this would be the month of October. Yeah. Yep.
Right.
Depending on when you're listening. Hello, future people.
Correct. So they will be up there, presumably. You should be able just to be able to use that if you just want the mechanics information from there. That's largely it. I mean, largely it is just another book with, it's just made for a $20 buy-in for someone who wants the character information instead of the $40 player's handbooks.
Okay.
But, I mean, if the most part, if you can get the, you can pretty much pretty easily get the original player's handbook pretty cheap nowadays.
Right.
If you want that, that does give you a lot more options in general and more information, and I'd probably advise going with that.
Okay. Anything from either of you other two guys? You've spent some time, Rob, looking through this too, or not? Or has Brian just been, mine?
No. Brian has actually been the opposite of mine. He's like, Rob, check this out. And opens up, and I see two pages, and I have enough chance to actually read like three words.
Okay. Like, oh.
But now the rules compendium is definitely worth grabbing.
Okay.
That's one of the things that I wanted to get at the end of 3.5, despite the fact that I knew 4th edition was coming out and everything. It was just, that was that last book that I wanted to get a hold of because it clarified.
All your rules in one place.
Yeah.
For example, like, as an edition goes on, new things are introduced. The player's handbook doesn't have rules for summoned creatures, for example.
Right.
The rules compendium does have everything from the player's handbook and everything from later supplements already there.
So, should Sergeant Gates look at the essentials line then?
He might want to, honestly.
Maybe. Yeah.
Because at this point, although they're saying, oh, don't worry, all your stuff is not going to change, that stuff is
totally
all still
is.
Compatible. It is. The essentials is changing certain things.
Okay.
And the essentials are the new starting point. Basically, what it comes down to is if you already have all the previous stuff, you don't need to get the essentials, especially if you have the character builder, because all that stuff will update for you.
Right.
However, if you're just starting, you probably might as well get the essentials, because pretty soon the rawr that the community's throwing out is going to go away, and everybody will just accept the essentials, and we'll just move on.
Okay. Another question that I have, especially for people that are just starting out, and I'm going to pull out some things out of my bag today.
Out of your what? I'm sorry.
Yes, out of my bag today, my plastic bag. I went to our new Hastings.
You're usually pulling things out of somewhere else.
I went to the Hastings today, and they've totally redone their store, and they've got a lot of new things. And
what, the B. Dalton
cool
closed?
Yes, the B. Dalton closed in our neighborhood. Now, you can still find it in Topeka. Wizards of the Coast, and this is, again, for people that may not be very experienced with gaming. For those of us I don't know about this, I find them interesting to just flip through and read and see what people are creating. But they have done, Wizards of the Coast puts out these 4th edition, essentially pre-built games for you. So this one that I picked up today, Dungeons & Dragons The Slaying Stone, an adventure for characters of the first level by Logan...
Nice.
I'm going to say Bonner.
Hey,
yeah, yes,
friend of
it
ours.
Is Logan Bonner. He is a friend of ours from here at Fort Hays. He's one of the other founding members of Cat G.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yep. Well, see, there we go. We're supporting a hometown person. And how come he's not on
the
show
anymore?
Because it's kind of hard to get a hold of him sometimes with him being living in Washington.
Well, get a hold of him and let's get him on the show. So what this does, what these things do, is it sets up your environment. It sets up the encounters that you have, and basically it is a Dungeon Master's game in a box, essentially, the way I look at it. It even includes a really nice map for your encounters to take place on. It gives you all the monsters that are in there. It tells you what treasures are in there. And then it lets your first level characters, and they have these all the way, I think I've seen them up to level 21.
I think they there's got, all the way through.
Yeah, yeah, there's epic probably level. Something all the way through epic.
Which is level 30?
30 is the last level.
Okay. So, Rodrigo, you've borrowed a couple of these from me recently. Right. What are your thoughts on this?
Hate them.
Why?
And it's important that people understand that this is just a purely personal thing. It's not that they are poorly put together. It's not that the illustrations aren't nice. It's not that the maps aren't cool. I just don't do packaged adventures because they are, first off... And they've done...
They're the lazy man's way to play Dungeons
and
Dragons.
It's not even that. There's really no judgment that goes into it for me. Like, if you want to use them, then that's fine. I mean, it's completely reasonable. It's monsters and maps and all this stuff already done for you.
Yeah, I think that makes it easy. I mean, if you're wanting to set up a game very quickly, you know, you and I have spent some time talking about setting up games and building games, and we had a discussion last week that you're probably spending... at least an hour building for every hour that we play.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be some people that don't want to do that.
Right. And, you know, there, especially in games where the point of the game is that you are a group of adventurers running around, you know, hoping to get money out of cracking things in the head,
mm-hmm.
then these adventures are great because you are playing what is pretty much an episodic game.
Right.
And these make for great episodes.
Right.
In today's installment of Headcrackers.
Right. We've got package number one. Now, what about you two, Ryan or Rob? Have you guys looked at these? Or?
I do look at prepackaged adventures sometimes, but I like very rarely use them.
Mm-hmm.
Also largely because I very rarely run.
Right,
but, yeah, even when I do run, I tend to not to. I may just take, you know, like an encounter or two out of them just,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the sake of quickness.
And of course,
which is also reasonable.
Yeah, and they also have a complete book, Dungeon Delves,
right.
yep. That lets you do those things too. I pick them up because I enjoy reading them
yes.
and reading the story and seeing how people set up certain encounters and the backstory that goes into that. And especially some of the things that I find interesting for people that are having trouble building interactions between the players and the NPCs is they actually say, you know, for example, not this one specifically, but another one. If your adventurers are walking around town and they happen to go to the market and they start asking questions, here are some possible responses that the NPCs may give that right. should lead the player to the next point in their journey. And so I think some of those kinds of things might help people who are trying to figure out how to develop those interactions between characters.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with using those for... like just as is or for adding to your campaign or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I am, although a little less vehement about it with Rodrigo, I personally wouldn't be using any of those because part of the DMing process.
I'm a purist.
Yeah. No, part of my DMing process is I enjoy making the story. Like that's part of the creative process for me. Without that, I don't get everything out of it that mm-hmm. I'd be putting into actually, because the DMing part is the work. Like, I enjoy watching my players go all out on me
mm-hmm.
and just letting them do whatever while I sit back and listen to them converse. But other than that, like running encounters and everything, it becomes more work than enjoyment at a certain point because I'm having to think through tactically, having to keep track of so much. I get the fulfillment out of creating this world,
mm-hmm.
watching other people enjoy what I'm putting forth as a creative endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
So the prepackaged ones just wouldn't normally be for me. However, I would absolutely love to run in that one because I know Logan is a good DM because I've run under him.
Okay. Well, you know, there are some other podcasts out there where they have used some of these prepackaged things and have run them. But, you know, if Logan's out there and listening and he wants to run us through one of his adventures, that'd be pretty cool.
That would be cool.
If that is your real name, by the way.
Why?
I think that there's an important place for a pregen. And a pregen is a very useful tool. But as with any tool, I think everybody's going to have their preferred versions. They're going to have their preferred tools. And I think for Rodrigo, like myself, when I was running the game, half the fun is the time you spend in the world building. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you go into a pregen and let's say you've done some of your world bending, you want to run a pregen, there are times where the amount of work it takes to tweak a pregen to work in the universe you're working with mm-hmm. is actually such that you might as well have just generated your own adventure.
That's right. Actually sort of sometimes even the case just with the pregens and the worlds that they have created. Some of these mm-hmm. adventures don't make a lot of sense in Eberron, mm-hmm. or, you know, an Eberron adventure won't make as much sense in a Forgotten Realms setting.
Right.
So that's important to know also. And I consider that to be a good thing, because it means that the settings are different enough that, you know, there's a reason to play in different settings. And then one last thing is that just because you're getting running a prepackaged adventure doesn't mean that there's not going to be any prep work, because you know your party, mm-hmm. and you might know the direction that they go in. The PCs always find a way to derail the adventure.
Yes.
And
I think that was a personal shot at us, gentlemen.
Oh, certainly not. Hey. I have been derailed by people long before I met any of you. It's mostly just at my college group. But
that's what makes RPGs fun.
It is. No, it is. And it absolutely is. But although they do a good job of saying, well, your PCs may, instead of talking to this old man, choose to murder him. So here's what you should do. Right. If that happens, they won't always be able, you know, there's only so many things that they can foresee.
Right.
And you probably play with at least one totally crazy guy who's just going to go out just off the reservation and do something insane.
Whenever I built my adventure, I kind of tried to do it in the vein of how these were built, mm-hmm. and so I had all this stuff, and I really wasn't prepared for a Minotaur
right.
to be part of the group,
exactly.
and it threw me completely off of what I was trying to do and accomplish. So it was a little different that way. Speaking of blowing the DM's minds, Marley writes in and says, "I'm a 23-year-old female who lives in Kansas. Thanks so much for the entertainment and the explanations that you guys do in Critical Hit. By the way, if you guys have any suggestions on how to make your GM's head explode, I would be much obliged."
Matthew?
This is your forte.
Sounds like a Matthew question.
Well, it does depend on what you mean by make their head explode.
Yeah,
like, there are times when Rodrigo will be, "And there are these three steps."
Right.
And then I will go off on a riff about how it's a good thing there aren't 39, or maybe there's a baby carriage falling down the steps. If there were only 12 steps, maybe we'd all have to stop drinking. And about the third time he starts to tell us about the steps, there is a clear warning in his voice. So I'm not sure I want to make his head explode with rage, but I think that the main thing that you want to make sure that you are taking into account is it's a collaborative effort. Mm-hmm. And Rodrigo has admitted that certain major aspects of this campaign actually came from us. Mm-hmm. For instance, I believe the Exilarchy was something that Brian inserted into his backstory that then became a big part of the game. Mm-hmm. So I think if you want to really make their head explode in a good way, I want you to look at everything that he's doing, and don't look at just what he's showing you or what he's telling you. Look at what that underlying theme is and try to find that moment where you can say, "And by the way, there's this underground race of robots in your world, and they're, you know, doing," and then all of a sudden you'll have that, "What?" Then again, if you want to make him really mad, I recommend making fun of the way he talks and just going like this and going, "Hi, my name is Rodrigo, and this is how I talk."
Michael.
And make sure that he doesn't actually talk that way before you do it, because that'll make him really crazy.
Michael writes in and he says, "I've got a couple of questions. The first one deals with immunities and damage types. If a power does multiple damage types and the person getting hit is immune or resistant to one of those types of damage, does the full immunity still take effect? So the person takes no damage even though their damage being done, is that a person immune to it or not?"
No. How that actually specifically works, you have to have resistance or immunity to all of the damage type that is being dealt to you. For example,
let's say I'm doing lightning damage.
If you're doing lightning damage and I'm resist 10 lightning, I will take 10 off of whatever the damage you do.
Okay.
In Alex's campaign, I'm currently playing a character who almost all of my attacks deal both lightning and thunder damage.
Mm-hmm.
So if something is resistant to just lightning, which Alex actually specifically threw at us last week, and I was upset for a moment, and then I realized, wait a minute, everything I have does thunder as well.
Yeah.
So it's getting hit with the thunder damage, and it's still dealing the full amount of damage. The resistance does not apply at all.
Okay.
It kind of breaks down to Steven is wearing, you know, a fireproof Nomex suit. And if I go Cactus Jack and hit him with a flaming 2x4, yes, he's immune to fire, but I still just hit him with a 2x4.
Yes, that is a surprisingly apt analogy for this.
The second question deals with damage dice and criticals.
Why is it surprising, Rodrigo?
Some classes like Ranger or Assassin have powers that add damage, like Hunter's Quarry or Assassin's Shroud. I was wondering if when a crit is scored and you are dealing that extra damage, does that also become max damage, or must I still roll for it?
No, you still roll it.
Okay.
Anything that tacks on damage separate of the attack itself must be rolled. That also goes for critical dice that you get from your magic weapons
and
high crit weapons.
Okay. My final question, this is from Michael. My final question pertains mainly to the assassin. There are certain powers where you roll multiple times to determine if you hit or not. The more times you hit, the more damage you deal. So my question is, if a critical is scored on one of those dice, do you still do the full overflow dice? And if so, if multiple crits are rolled, do you multiple overflow damage?
I'm not entirely sure what he's referring to.
Are you aware?
There's actually... Assassin isn't the only class that has powers like this.
Okay.
I think a couple of the other... I think both the Ranger and the Rogue have a couple of powers that are similar, where... Oh, no, Warlock has a couple of them. I've been doing a lot of work with Warlock since I'm playing, like, three of them.
Yeah.
But the Warlock has a couple of powers where you roll... You make an attack roll against the same... You make three attack rolls against the same target.
Mm-hmm.
If only one of the attacks hits, you deal 1d6 plus your modifier and damage.
Right.
If two of the attacks hits, you deal 1d6 plus your modifier plus your int modifier and damage, because int is their secondary.
Right.
And if all three of the attacks hit, you deal 2d6 plus your con or charisma plus your int and damage. Okay. So it's a little extra damage each time. I would say if one of those is a critical, then you would get the max damage for
that hit.
Well, for the number of hits that you have scored.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you only hit once,
right,
you would get 6 plus your modifier.
Right.
If you hit all three times, you would get 12 plus your modifier plus your modifier.
Okay. All right. Well, Michael, hopefully that answers your question for you. And really, listeners, we're going to turn this into a full-on Q&A, listener feedback session. One more thing before we go. I'll pull another something out of the box.
Ah!
What about this? Have you seen these, Rodrigo? What grouping is this? Is this the new stuff?
Yeah, it's the newest one.
Okay, these are the new miniatures. I picked up a couple of boxes of these, so we'll open one box today. One box today and another box in another episode. But the new miniatures from Wizards of the Coast, they didn't send these to us. I did buy them. If they would like to send us some sets like they did previously, we'd be much appreciative. So I'm going to just open this up. What's Lords of Madness about? What's the backstory on these?
I think it's largely just tying into their whole theme around the Player's Handbook 3 and Monster Manual 3 by tying in some of the Far Realm stuff into the game.
Okay, so what do we got here?
That looks like a Nyogi.
Grub Swarm.
Yep.
Or rat Grub?
Rot Grub.
Oh.
Nyogi Great Old Master.
Let's see, we got a
Mimic.
What do we
is
got
that
here?
A
treasure chest.
It's just a treasure chest.
Yeah. Well, you.
Hey, we have.
It can be a mimic if you want it to be.
And we've got Nyogi, the Great Old Master. You guys already said that. And then.
What's the big guy?
I thought there was a big guy. Oh, here it is.
The audio on this segment is awesome. It sounds like we're living in a world of bubble.
Well, that's what you hear, Matthew. That's not. Oh, my goodness. Look at this guy. Ooh.
Oh, nice.
Looks like a Reaver demon looking
guy.
This
looks like a Rodrigo monster.
When the bacon is ready, I'd like some.
Look at that.
Now I'm hungry.
Beebolith.
Oh.
That's
nice.
Awesome.
Oh, wow. I don't even know what that is, but it freaks me out. Yeah, it looks like a wasp.
It's like a giant
face flaps.
Spider monkey monster thing.
No, nothing freaks me out worse than wasps.
And, of course, the nice thing about these is these come with the little character cards
that
have everything about them, so that's kind of neat as well. Alex is over here chomping at the bit, ready to... I got an orc archer. I got a rock. Whoops.
Spellweaver. This thing's kind of cool.
Yep.
So maybe we can incorporate those in a future show, if Rodrigo so inclines to use those. That's more than...
Rodrigo only inclines to 40 degrees, though.
Oh, one final question before we get out of here. And this is a question that I have, which is going to lead us directly into our next episode next week for you guys, about 30 seconds from now for the rest of us after this show ends. You know, when we went from the end of Four Against the Void right into Celestial Crusade, Aurum actually had an errata spell change. His magic missiles went from rolling dice to suddenly being an automatic hit.
Right.
And I tried to weave that into into the game where suddenly Orm's like, oh, my powers have changed. This is interesting. Maybe something has happened
in this
land. But we're going to level up in the next episode. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think, when it comes to getting new powers and abilities, if I remember correctly, it seems in the past we've just gained these powers and abilities, and it's just like, hey, now I've got a new power or ability.
Well, we've talked about it.
Talked about it, but have we actually in-game, you know, said, hey, I've going through this book and I found a new spell that I have now learned, or someone trains me on this kind of thing? How do you deal with these kind of power-ups or level-ups in your game?
In this game specifically,
right?
It depends on the player, because each of you, and you know, along with Smith, things developed for different reasons.
Right.
Yes, you're all getting a new power. Yes, you're all hitting that level.
Mm-hmm.
But Orym is presumably, as a wizard, constantly doing magical research.
Right.
And constantly observing the world around him. And
right.
Developing new, more potent spells.
Right.
Randus is also constantly experimenting with things.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere from weaponry to arcane admixtures and random stuff like that.
Right.
Smith just had a new magic cyst develop somewhere in his spleen, and magic would pour out of it.
When Smith did it, that was very natural in the terms of the story. But
and
not to compare this game to Wizards of World of Warcraft, but you know, when you level up, even if you're out in the middle of the wilderness, and you have the ability to you actually don't get those new powers. You actually have to go back to town, go to the place where you learn the spells, and spend money on the new spells that you want to get, that you're qualified to get at that level.
I like the way you preface what you do by saying that you're not going to do it, and then you do it anyway.
No, because I'm trying to figure out, how does that work? And I mean, do we need to apply that same thing here? Or
this one is actually a very reasonable way of approaching it from WoW for a change.
Not for a change. It usually is. It's just that at the beginning of the show, Steven's every other comparison was to WoW.
World of Warcraft. This is how we would do it.
Yes, that is something.
Frame of reference.
And here's the thing. I'm never, if you noticed, whenever you guys introduce a new power, I ask you to describe it.
Right.
And sometimes, if enough time has passed, I'll ask you to describe things again or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because that's important. And I don't necessarily want to put you guys on the spot, because sometimes it's not relevant to the plot as to how you got your third level spell.
Okay.
However, you have control over that.
Mm-hmm.
If you run onto the deck of your flying ship and say, hey guys, look what I learned to do.
Right.
I mean, that's something that's completely within your ability to do.
Okay.
I believe
I had to go sleep so I could do it again.
So far, Oh, no, I'm tired. Torque has had at least one training montage.
Right. And I know we've done that occasionally, but I didn't know what, you know, how DMs or GMs deal with this in game where, you know, the last time we left our characters, they were out in the city street.
Mm-hmm.
In that process, they've leveled up. Does that mean in the very next thing, if we, you know, depending on how this deals, does that mean I can automatically start using my new powers?
No. There's always the assumption that you have developed. I mean, it depends on your character.
Sure.
That would make sense for Smith, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It would make sense that just after some period of time, something grows out of his forehead, and now he can shoot laser beams out of it. Right.
Right.
It doesn't.
Something disgusting happens, and Smith has a power.
Exactly. It might make sense for even for Torque, who has just, you know, hit that level of athleticism after being hit over the head enough times and hitting things over the head enough times, that he can now, you know,
hit him over the head in this new way.
Dash 15 feet and explode whatever he touches.
Right. Okay, it was a question that I was thinking, because it's like, ooh, I've got a cool new spell. How did I learn that cool new spell?
Well,
and we will
at the beginning of
the next game.
I will basically just repeat what you just said.
Okay,
hey, you got a cool new spell. How did you learn that collision spell?
All right, and from there we will pick it up next time. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to this episode of Critical Hit, a Major Spoilers Dungeons & Dragons podcast. If you have any questions, comments, thoughts, ideas, whatever it may be, all you need to do is send us an email to podcast@majorspoilers.com, and we may spend a future episode talking about it or just drop it in our normal conversation. But until next time, here's hoping all of your dice rolls are critical hits.
Visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.